Are we set to go? One more. Okay. Okay, we're going to call the first case now. When the lawyers are arguing, you will see in the screen that has just a picture of the court, a green card that says start. Then you'll get a yellow card that gives you 5 minutes and a red card which tells you to stop. So when you're conducting your argument, you'll have to pay attention to those cards and they'll always appear in the same place. So I will call our first case of the day, Warren versus Meisner. Counsel, are you prepared to begin? Okay, he's still muted. One moment, counsel. We're not getting your feed in. Okay, let's start again. Counsel for Mr. Warren, are you prepared to proceed?
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Okay, please do them.
Okay. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. This is Robert Meyerhoff appearing for Mr. Warren. The Warren case is very similar to the Starks case. Both cases started in the circuit court, and there was a decision in Warren denying him the ability to start in the circuit court, and that was based on the Starks case. And in the decision of the circuit court stated that in Starks, because there was no post-conviction motion brought in the trial court claiming the trial counsel was ineffective, that there could be the direct appeal, and then there was a direct appeal, which was denied. Then there was a 974-06 motion brought in the circuit court, and then the Warren court denied that based on the language in Starks. And it stated that if there was no post-conviction motion in the circuit court on direct appeal, the fault was the appellate attorney and not the post-conviction attorney. And therefore, the motion had to be brought by a writ of habeas corpus, a writ for a petition of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals. Because the Court of Appeals is the best judge of an appellate attorney.
But counsel, isn't what you're arguing about here is that trial counsel was ineffective?
Right. And that's
okay.
And that's
so
what,
in Stark, what they were arguing about was whether appellate counsel was ineffective. You're saying that trial counsel was ineffective, and that's the basis on which you brought the 974-06, correct?
That's correct, right.
Okay. So I think there's a difference between this case and Starks because you're arguing about two different things in those two different cases.
In the motions for reconsideration in Starks and in Justice Prosser's concurring opinion, he said that these cases, even in Starks and in my case, the real argument was about the trial counsel. Both cases, they really wanted, in the end, they wanted a Mockner hearing. And that's why the confusion, I think, in Starks was that it was based on Knight, but the Knight case did not involve an ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And what they're really going for in all of these cases that deal with these post-conviction counsel being ineffective is the ineffectiveness of the trial counsel. And the mistake is one of omission. And here's another problem that in the Starks decision and in the Warren decision is that the mistake is by post-conviction counsel because he did not bring the motion against the trial counsel in the circuit court. So the mistake was by post-conviction counsel and it happened in the trial court. And that's the place that it should be corrected by a 974-06 motion.
Isn't the issue really that any motion for ineffective assistance of trial counsel has to start at the trial level in terms of post-conviction, that whether you labeling them post-conviction counsel, appellate counsel, I mean, in a sense, they're kind of the same at the beginning, right? Because every ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim has to start in a trial court with the post-conviction motion, right?
Correct.
And so isn't that really where the confusion lies? Even if Starks had different facts, and it isn't the claim that you're making that this should belong in the circuit court and that we need to clarify this point for the public and for the bench and bar, because there seems to be some confusion about that.
That's correct. And I'm saying that you can look at it as a mistake of omission rather than commission, because the language in Starks held that if there's a failure to bring a motion that trial counsel is ineffective in the trial court, then all further appeals have to be made in the Court of Appeals. And I'm saying, and Justice Prosser said, and all of the motions for reconsideration said, is that the mistake was still made by the post-conviction counsel because he didn't bring the motion against trial counsel in the circuit court. And therefore, it should be corrected in the circuit court. The distinction between post-conviction counsel and appellate counsel isn't helpful here because they aren't judging. Starks did not recognize a mistake of omission rather than commission.
Are you suggesting that in Starks we were focused on the identity of counsel and what role he was playing rather than the venue in which the error occurred, and that what we should be doing is concentrating on the venue where the error allegedly occurred and then determining based on that how the error should be addressed?
That's exactly correct, right? And
if you agree to that, then is Starks distinguishable in your opinion?
No, I think Starks is exactly the same as my case, because in Starks, what they were really going after was the ineffectiveness of trial counsel. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do in my case. Both cases should be handled the same by a 974-06 motion in the trial court. And another reason to do it that way is that most of these cases are brought by prisoners, and the 974-06 is much easier to work with. And I think it was even designed because it was easier than a petition for writ of habeas corpus. In the reconsideration in the Starks matter, both sides wanted to go back to Rothering, you know, which was the saying that if there was a petition brought claiming ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel because he failed to bring ineffectiveness of trial counsel, that should be handled in the circuit court. And as I stated before, Judge Prosser in his concurring opinion said the same thing. And now both sides in the Warren case are saying the same thing, that the language in Stark should be changed so that we go back to Rothering and that the 974 be handled in the circuit court. And then it could be handled by the trial judges, because the omission was in the trial court and the trial judges are best equipped to handle the ultimate mistake that's being alleged here, which is by trial counsel. Now, what the parties don't agree on in the Warren case is the remedy. The state says to affirm the Court of Appeals and then send Warren back to the beginning and let Warren try to ask the Court of Appeals to extend the time for appeal under 809.82 sub 2. But in my opinion, that does not apply, because it only doesn't apply to 974-06. It only applies to 809.30 appeal. Therefore, what I think we should do for Warren is to say that the language in Starks is changed to reassert Rothering, and then to construe the writ as properly filed in the Court of Appeals, and then say that construe it as a 974-06 and direct the case back to the circuit court. Or if you don't do that, you could decide ask the Court of Appeals to decide the case on the merits. Either way, Mr. Warren is entitled to a decision in this case, either in the trial court, but if not that, then in the circuit court.
Mr. Myroff, I would agree with you that it appears the only issue here now after reading the briefs is the remedy, because I think the state concedes the confusion, but the question, what I think they're recommending, and I want you to respond to it, is that Mr. Warren now go to the Court of Appeals and ask to appeal his original post-conviction motion, even though the time has passed in the Court of Appeals, and so ask for a retroactive date. And why is that not an okay remedy?
Because they're asking that the extension be done under 809.82 sub 2, and I believe that only applies to 809.30 cases, and this is a 974-06 case.
All right, so you're saying it doesn't fit within 809.30, it's a post-conviction motion case, and therefore that statute doesn't apply?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. What do you feel what do you think about what the public defender is also asking? And I know they'll speak to this, but for us to also clarify paragraph 29 of Starks and also paragraph 41, what are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, I read the public defender's brief and I do agree with it, yeah. Okay. I can't remember those paragraphs specifically, but generally, I think what the public defender is asking is to go back to the Rothering interpretation, and I would agree with that. And I also, one last point I'll make is that it was unusual that in Starks, Rothering was basically overruled, but it wasn't even mentioned in Starks. So I think that was part of the confusion also. Thank you.
Counsel, there is a part of Starks that I'd like you to comment on, and I'm not looking at the paragraphs that were mentioned earlier, but rather at paragraph 4, which says this: the attorney who represented him, Starks, after his conviction did not file any post-conviction motions and instead pursued direct appeal. He was thus not Starks' post-conviction counsel, but rather was his appellate counsel. And so what the court was talking about is the test for appellate counsel in Starks. You're talking about the test to be applied for ineffective trial counsel, correct?
Well, yeah. They made a distinction between appellate counsel and post-conviction counsel. And the post-conviction counsel
is trial counsel.
Was really right. The post-conviction counsel, they said, should have, if he didn't complain about trial counsel, then the fault is with the appellate attorney, and that should be done in the circuit, in the Court of Appeals. That was a ruling in Starks, right?
Right.
But the answer to that is two parts. One is that the fault was of post-conviction. Even in Starks, the fault was of post-conviction counsel because he failed to bring the case against the trial counsel. He failed to ask for a Mockner hearing. So it was an error of omission rather than commission. And in these cases, like which it talks about in Rothering, you're really asking for a Mockner hearing. And the judge of that, the best judge of what the trial counsel did wrong is the circuit court and not the Court of Appeals.
Okay, your time is just about concluded.
Okay. Yeah, I'm through, Your Honor.
A couple more minutes.
I don't have anything more to say. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Attorney Ehrman, are you ready to proceed? You're still muted, so just 1 minute. He's still muted, Tammy. Just 1 minute. Okay, I think you're good to go now, according to what I'm seeing, Attorney Ehrman.
Okay. All right. I'm Joe Ehrman, appearing for the State Public Defender as amicus counsel. And I'm joining the bandwagon asking this court after Starks to sort of do a do-over in articulating appellate procedure for litigating ineffective assistance counsel claims in collateral post-conviction proceedings. And I guess I'll start, Justice, with your comment, Justice Rogenczak. In Starks, what was being alleged was his direct appeal attorney was ineffective for not raising an ineffective claim of trial counsel.
That's right.
And it's more accurate to describe the person as a Rule 80930 direct appeal attorney, not appellate counsel or post-conviction counsel. Because in Wisconsin, all appeals start at the circuit court level. The direct appeal counsel, after a notice of intent is filed, the record remains in the circuit court. Direct appeal counsel evaluates whether or not to bring a 972-402 post-conviction motion or file a notice of appeal. So the error in Starks occurred at the post-conviction stage when direct appeal counsel failed to file a motion and instead filed a notice of appeal. So under the Rothering, Knight, Mockner framework, Starks correctly filed a 97406 motion,
right?
Because he was alleging that his direct appeal attorney failed to do something while the case was still in the circuit court. And we get there because in this court in State versus Knight, said what's critical or how we're going to decide whether or not collateral review occurs via 97406 or habeas is the place or stage at which the error occurred. And so in Starks, Starks' collateral post-conviction attorney properly filed a 97406 motion. And I think the majority got off track by labeling that person appellate counsel. The error didn't occur in the appellate court because it couldn't have. He couldn't raise ineffective assistance of trial counsel in the appellate court because he didn't first do it at the circuit court level. So under the framework, sort of the procedural framework that's been in place for decades, the attorney did it correctly. And I think this court mislabeled it and got off track by labeling this an error of appellate counsel.
I think that's what was complained about, is that the attorney who was serving as appellate counsel didn't allege ineffectiveness of trial counsel for not filing a 97406, right?
But it's while the case was at the post-conviction stage. They're the same person.
Yeah.
And so he committed an error before he got to the appellate court. And so
sometimes they're not the same person, though, as you know.
It's pretty rare. I mean, all cases start there. And the only way it would change is if somebody filed a motion to withdraw, you know, between the two. I mean, the case is always evaluated at the post-conviction stage before notice of appeal. And that's where IAC has to be raised. Okay. So he's not, in Starks, he wasn't saying his appellate lawyer made a mistake in the Court of Appeals. He's saying his direct appeal counsel, the same person, made a mistake earlier in the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I don't think it's possible to reconcile Starks with Mockner, Rothering, and Knight. You would have to create a new rule. And you could do that. I mean, there currently is one exception that this court has carved out where an error that occurs at the circuit court level gets litigated via habeas, and that's for a blown appeal deadline. In Kyles versus Pollard, you ruled that even though trial counsel you're alleging trial counsel is ineffective for failing to file a notice of intent, that gets litigated by habeas in the Court of Appeals for two reasons. One, the Court of Appeals should control its docket. But two, there's a Supreme Court rule, 809.82, that says the Court of Appeals gets to do that. If you adopt what Stark says, you need to either reverse or modify Rothering and Knight. And you could do that because this is, you know, Knight was just a matter of, was decided as a matter of policy, not based on any statute or court rule.
Is there any good reason, though, to disturb the Knight-Rothering procedure?
No, emphatically no. Because how it would work then is you would be filing a writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals, and then automatically you would have to file a motion to remand to the circuit court, because by definition, ineffective assistance of counsel claims are fact intensive, and you need the trial attorney's testimony to resolve it. So if you adopt the Starks rule, you'd be telling attorneys or pro se people, because most of these are litigated pro se, you've got to file a writ of habeas corpus in the Court of Appeals, then move to have the case remanded to the circuit court for fact finding, and then move back to the Court of Appeals. It's inefficient and wasteful, and you gain nothing.
Is it fair to say that the error that the Starks court made was looking at the post-conviction or appellate attorney, however you want to characterize that individual, as looking at that attorney as wearing two hats when in fact the attorney only wears one hat, but there may be different issues to litigate and some belong in the circuit court and some belong in the Court of Appeals. Is that a fair summary?
That's right. It's a direct appeal attorney who litigates things at a post-conviction stage or an appellate stage. But he's not post-conviction counsel or appellate counsel. He's both, by definition, in Wisconsin. Because the cases always start there, direct appeal attorney is both. Unless there's the weird situation where somebody litigates a post-conviction motion, moves to withdraw, a new attorney's appointed. But that's not typical. You know,
do you think we need to overrule Starks, or is it sufficient to simply withdraw that errant language?
You don't need to overrule the holding. It's the language. It's just, and I would just urge this court to rearticulate Rothering, Knight, Mockner, and just have it supersede the language. Have this decision be the case where you explain what this appellate procedure is, and just say that it supersedes any inconsistent language. But just, you know, going through just the process and articulate it in one place.
So could you address, I'm sorry, were you done, Justice Bradley? Counsel, could you address just the remedy piece a little bit here? There's a statement in Rothering that says that a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel should be raised in the trial court either by a petition for habeas corpus or a motion under 974-6. The citation to a petition for habeas cites to the Knight case and says, the footnote says, it may be appropriate in some circumstances for a petition for writ of habeas corpus to be filed. So what I'm wondering is, do you think we need to construe that? Could we just remand this back as a, you know, habeas petition filed in the wrong forum, because maybe we told them to file it in the wrong forum, the court system did? And could you at least address some of those procedural.
So what I would urge the court to do is say that Starks didn't intend to overrule or change Rothering and Knight.
Right, I'm talking about the remedy.
I'm getting it. Yeah. So here, the circuit court barred the door, said you're in the wrong place, go to the Court of Appeals. Court of Appeals barred the door and said, no, you're in the wrong place, go back there. And I think the better remedy here would just be to reinstate the original filing as improperly dismissed. And the reason I say that is the timing of this matters, maybe not so much in this case, but if a person doesn't properly file his collateral post-conviction petition, it has implications for federal court, because properly filing one tolls the deadline for federal court. And I want to make sure that people don't get caught out in the cold on that, that if they filed a 974-06 motion like Warren did here, he did the right thing. He didn't do anything wrong. He filed it correctly. The circuit court erred in dismissing it. So I think the better remedy here would just be to remand the case back for further proceedings on the original motion.
What are the are there any statutory or other challenges to doing that we would need to address in a remand of that sort?
Well, no, I think the case would just be you'd be ruling that everything was just put on hold at that point, and you're resuming it at that point. There's no deadlines for collateral post-conviction proceedings in Wisconsin. There are in federal court, but there aren't any deadlines here. You can file one at any time. I mean, yeah, I guess in theory, Warren could simply refile a new petition because he never had a ruling on the merits, but then that would cost him in federal court because he's passed a year now, so he couldn't file a federal habeas. And I don't know if he wants to or not, but I think the cleanest remedy is to just send it back to the place where the error first occurred, which was in the circuit court, which should have heard the Rothering motion, if that makes sense.
Counsel, I'm glad that Justice Hagedorn asked that question, because when I read your brief, it seemed like you punted on it.
Well, I don't represent, Warren. I'm just talking about procedure, and I didn't mean to do that. I was also running into a word limit, and I was trying to clean up the law.
Well, that's right. Punt, pass, or kick. Indeed, understandably. But now you seem to be embracing what the remedy is advanced by the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. That's what they're suggesting, I understand it. Is that
right? And the reason is, I think the reason Wachtel's doing that is the federal thing, that if somebody was ruled to not have properly filed their collateral post-conviction motion in Wisconsin, that wouldn't toll the federal deadlines. They'll just be out in the cold. And I think, here he did file it correctly. And so that's the reason, I think, for that.
Thank you very much. His time is over, Justice Bradley. If you want to ask another question, that's certainly fine. I'll just give more time to the state.
No, I didn't notice that his time was over, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, are you ready to proceed on behalf of the state?
I am, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Robert Probst, and I appear on behalf of the respondent in this matter, Warden Michael Meisner. Your Honors, this case presents the court with an opportunity on two levels, a macro level and a micro level. At the macro level, this case is about what the law is and what it should be. And more to the point, it's about what the law has been since 2013, when this court issued its decision in Starks. Only this court can withdraw language from that opinion, if it chooses to do so, or change its holding in that case to comport with the discussions we've been having here. The second issue is the micro level, which is how the Starks case impacts the individual petitioner here. That language in Starks that the state has identified in its brief caused the circuit court to conclude that the petitioner's habeas petition was filed in the wrong form. And it's certainly understandable why the circuit court reached that conclusion based on the language that that exists in Starks. So you can sort of see how the two levels sort of bleed together, the fact that the Starks language exists and the fact that it can be read to support the circuit court's decision here. Now, I want to pause for a second because we've talked a lot about remedy and about how we want to address the individual issue in this case and make sure that the petitioner has his day in court. And I would agree. I hope it's clear that everyone here believes he should have his day in court to some extent. His motion has not been reviewed at any point on the merits, as we like to say.
But what you're proposing is that the Court of Appeals have the discretion to grant him his day in court. Are you still sticking with that?
Your Honor, so I think the other parties are right that because we are looking at a 974-06 motion is a continuation of the original criminal action, but it is a civil proceeding. Because it is a civil proceeding, the extension under 80982 that would be possible in a criminal proceeding is not authorized under the statute here. So I think the easiest and simplest remedy is for this court, whatever it decides in this decision, to allow the petitioner to refile his petition at the circuit court level on the basis of this court's decision, whether it's called a sufficient reason, a change in the law. Those things are both concepts that apply here and very specifically to the petitioner, because as we've said, the petitioner's claims were not litigated, not reviewed on the merits at all because of this forum issue. And if we resolve the forum issue, then the petitioner can have his day in court. I do want to be clear, however.
I'm sorry, go ahead. If you
want to
finish your sentence first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please come back to me. I just want to finish the thought. I do want to be clear, however, that that review is, it's not the same as what would have happened on direct appeal. I like to think of a direct appeal as a, well, we are in a the great state of Wisconsin, a barn silo, just going straight up and down, right? During the person's direct appeal, they start at the trial court level. They have a judgment of conviction following a jury trial or a plea. They go up. There might be post-conviction motions, then the court of appeals, and then this court. That's the direct appeal process that every person is entitled to constitutionally in this state. Following that, the completion of that process, we have 97406, which allows for a person to collaterally attack. So from the side, collaterally attack their conviction, the propriety of that process. But it's important to note that the procedural posture we're in this case is one following the conclusion of the petitioner's direct appeal. He did have a direct appeal with counsel. That direct appeal did not involve any post-conviction proceedings because there was no need for them. The claims that were that needed to be raised on direct appeal had already been preserved, so there was no need for counsel to file a post-conviction motion.
Except so I would, except for the ineffective assistance claim, right?
Well, the current claims, yes, he would need to raise those first, and as we've talked about, and I think Your Honor pointed out correctly, the failure here really is the failure to file that post-conviction motion, just as in Starks. The issue was not preserved for appeal without that post-conviction motion in the circuit court alleging ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
Okay, can you address in the remedy you just mentioned, what about the issue of federal court? It sounds like you're saying he needs to file a new petition, which would mean that he could be out of luck in federal court, according to the timelines that they have there, as opposed to us remanding this directly to the circuit court and deeming it to be properly filed when it was and sure. Rejected.
So I have two responses to that question. I think you're right that counsel is right that there is an issue with habeas deadlines. I don't know that that would necessarily apply here because what counsel is talking about is an improperly filed motion. I do a lot of federal habeas work for the department. I don't see how his petition was improperly filed if he is doing his best essentially and just cannot get a hearing either before a review, before the circuit court or before the court of appeals. I guess I don't view that as an improperly filed, action or motion. It's the kind of thing where he's clearly trying to challenge his conviction. However, he's been stopped short of doing that first by the circuit court and then by the court of appeals. So I think the time that, during which this proceeding has gone, I guess I could make an argument that that time has been told for federal habeas purposes.
Right, you could make the argument, but it's not a guaranteed argument. So why would we put a defendant in a position
I guess I wouldn't, as a practitioner, I wouldn't do that. But the second issue and the reason why this is more complicated than I think just remanding it and having with instructions is what is before this court today is the Court of Appeals April 8th, 2019 order. That order denied the petitioner a night petition, concluding that, without addressing any of the merits, concluding that essentially that the petitioner had not made the showing he had to make because he had another adequate remedy at law. He could have appealed the circuit court's February 4th, 2019 decision. So what we're reviewing here is that Court of Appeals opinion.
Could you address the suggestion of essentially breathing new life into the original 97406 motion, whether you see any legal impediments to that suggested remedy? Put aside whatever your prudential concerns are. I'm curious about any legal issues with that route.
So I don't think there's any limitation with respect to the specific petition here. I don't think that it could be kicked on like another procedural ground. I think the What needs to happen is a review on the merits. That said, because we are in a collateral stage, and Your Honor knows as well, having served in the Court of Appeals, there are several tools that circuit court judges use to evaluate these collateral attack motions. For example, the motion can't be used to raise issues that have been previously raised. The motion can't be used to, their motion has to meet pleading requirements. There has to be specificity in terms of the allegations in the motions and, the remedies sought. So all those things are tools that circuit courts use in evaluating these motions. But they do have to do that at some level, and it didn't happen here. What happened here is not what we want to happen, but it is what happened as a result of the language that exists in this court's opinion, and that can only be changed, in our view, with the withdrawal of that language.
So just make sure I'm understanding. So in terms of, again, I'm just focusing on the remedy here for the moment. You would not see any legal impediments or other procedural, statutory, or impediments to us breathing new life into his unappealed original 97406 motion that was filed in the circuit court, where the court relied on Starks to say wrong forum, too bad. You don't see any legal impediments to that. That's one clarification. And I have a follow up, but go ahead and answer that question, please.
I do see an impediment to that, Your Honors, for the reason I just mentioned, which is that what we're reviewing right now is the Court of Appeals opinion denying a NIPE petition. We're not reviewing the circuit court's order from February that Your Honor is discussing. I would be very cautious about sort of reaching across the litigation streams to afford the petitioner relief there. And I think that there's a real risk that not necessarily that would be problematic in this case, but that there could be unintended consequences in other similar cases. And as opposing counsels mentioned, a lot of these are filed by pro se litigants. And, they might see that there's been some big change and not necessarily understand what that is. And that could trigger some floodgates around the state that we don't want to happen. So I think that's a concern that we don't want to have. I don't know if it would be extraordinary or superintending authority or something like that. But I don't think we want to have we don't want to have the template of reaching across cases like that. That's a concern I would have, Your Honor.
So your proposed remedy, there is this sort of sticky language in 97406, and I'm wondering how a refiled claim, I mean, maybe we can just say you have no Escalona bar, but, the idea of a refiled claim asserting the same thing that the circuit court already denied, we denied countless claims like that when I was on the Court of Appeals for raising an issue already raised and decided. So I'm curious, whether you find anything problematic in the language of 97406-4 or otherwise with proceeding along the route you're suggesting.
Sure. So, I think that language actually could be helpful here because, as Your Honor well knows, a defendant can demonstrate a sufficient reason for a failure to raise a claim earlier. And, he certainly did attempt to raise the claim. Let's be clear on that. It's not that he had a claim that he didn't raise, or he's trying to raise the same claim twice when having already received a ruling on the merits, he didn't get that. All he got was a wrong forum decision, essentially.
Right, but the statute says, the sufficient reason language says not asserted or inadequately raised, so that doesn't sort of clearly apply here.
Well, I do think that this, whatever this court decides in this decision, that will have an impact on the petitioner's individual case, which he could use to sort of supplement, I think, his motion to get him in the door, essentially, to say, having decided that the language the circuit court relied on to reject this person's petition, having decided that that language is withdrawn or incorrect, that would give him a sufficient reason, I think, to allow him to refile that. A change in the law, as I've said.
What about the possibility of just taking this habeas petition and remanding it to the circuit court? To allow them to address it and say, potentially appropriate vehicle, but wrong forum because of our mistake, the court system's mistake. What issues or problems do you see with that route, if any?
That's an incredibly rare remedy, I guess, Your Honor, so I'm not sure how that would play out. I don't see any particular legal problem with it as far as the option exists, and it is a creature of statute. So it's a possibility. I think that, as I've said, I think the easiest, cleanest way is for the petitioner to simply refile his petition with the understanding that this court has issued a decision in this case, and that that will necessarily impact whether the circuit court was correct or incorrect in its February 2019 order.
Why, counsel, are you advocating that now? What causes you to change? That's not the remedy you sought in your brief.
Your Honor, you're right. And I think what happened really is just I reviewed all of the briefs. And again, I would agree with the public defender's office. I'm not the counsel for the petitioner, but I do want for him to have his day in court. And I think the easiest remedy is the one that I've spoken of, as Attorney Meyerhoff pointed out, that statute 809-82 applies to a 809-30 appeal, a direct appeal, essentially, in which the Court of Appeals has great discretion to extend the time limits. We're not in that land here because even though 974-06 is a creature of the criminal process, it's a civil action, and that process would not, or that statute would not apply to the civil action. So I think the concept is certainly a good one. The idea that, this guy has tried to raise these claims and has been unable to do so, and he's never had any merits review. So we certainly want him to have some level of merits review. The problem is just worrying about whether affording the petitioner his remedy in this case lends itself to unintended consequences in other cases. That's, I guess, my concern there. So I think the remedy following briefing is the best one, the one that creates the least amount of confusion. That's kind of where I've ended up, Your Honor.
Go ahead, Justice Bradley. I can follow up after you.
What unintended consequences are you speaking of? Are you have caught that concern has caused you now to change your position on remedy?
Sure. Well, the remedy thing specifically, I'm not concerned about the unintended consequences with respect to that. I think the remedy is not possible because of the fact that this is a civil proceeding, so we can't extend that deadline. The unintended consequences that I'm concerned with, and opposing counsel has brought this up several times, is that we have a lot of pro se litigation, and if convicted persons see that this court has issued a decision affecting its holding in Starks, there might be a flood of litigation saying, hey, my post-conviction motion was denied on similar grounds, or I made a similar claim several years ago in the intervening time between 2020 and 2013 when this court issued its decision. The possibility exists certainly for litigants to try to use this as an opportunity to refile motions that they had been denied, years ago even. So I just want to be careful that however this court decides the case, I want the court to be clear that we're talking about a very specific set of facts here that the petitioner has shown, which is that he tried to raise a claim in the circuit court and was denied. He tried to raise a claim in the Court of Appeals and was denied. And so there's never really been an opportunity to address those claims on the merits. And the reason why is the language in Starks. So if a petitioner who's in an identical posture, that is to say someone who has had the same thing happen to them where their motion has been sort of kicked around on the basis of that language, they would certainly be under a decision in this case. They would probably be authorized to file a petition, or at least they might think they would be. So I think the concern is about a flood of litigation there, that there might be a lot of post-conviction litigation, a lot of motions filed in circuit courts, especially if this court issues a decision that in effect changes the law or says that it did or did not intend to do so in 2013.
But shouldn't those litigants have their day in court? Otherwise they're stuck in, I think, what the state public defender's office characterized as a Schrodinger's cat-like situation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. And I do want to emphasize that, Your Honor. It's a good point. We do want this petitioner to have his day in court, and he hasn't had that yet because of the confusion in this 2013 language. And I do want to speak to that in case any members of the court are concerned about the import of that language with respect to the Starks decision itself. The Starks decision itself has to do with the adoption of the clearly stronger standard for evaluating appellate counsel's performance on direct appeal. Basically, we ask the question when evaluating whether counsel performed efficiently on direct appeal by looking at whether the issues that a petitioner wants to now raise are clearly stronger than the issues that counsel did actually raise. That's the issue that Starks addressed and affirmatively addressed, and then this court revisited that extended that holding to post-conviction counsel as well in Romano, Georgia, the following year. That holding remains good law. And I think the central aspect of Starks in that respect with regard to that holding would be untouched by what the state is asking for here, which is to withdraw the problematic language. I'm thinking specifically of looking, for example, at paragraph 4. There's sort of a step missing there, as the parties have already talked about in the court's analysis, where, you know, appellate counsel may have been ineffective for failing to raise an issue on appeal. It's possible, but we don't know about that because there was never a post-conviction motion filed first to raise the claim against trial counsel that appellate counsel could later have theoretically raised. So without that missing step in the middle, the possibility of counsel raising an issue on appeal is not there. So I think that's really, it's just a factual misunderstanding more than a legal issue, because the issue that, like I said, there's just that step missing, that step of post-conviction counsel filing a post-conviction motion.
Counsel, what do you think about the request, as long as we are talking about Starks and modifying some of the language, the request to modify the language in paragraph 29 and paragraph 41?
I would agree with opposing counsel on that point. I think the position that the state articulated in our motions for reconsideration in Starks remains our position with respect to those issues. I don't see any problem with changing that language. I guess I'm saying I would agree with opposing counsel on that point. Are there any other questions?
Paragraph 29 was not the one I was looking at. I was looking at paragraph 4. But I don't see what needs to be changed in 29. So if you're going to focus on that and you want us to focus on that, why don't you tell me what's wrong with paragraph 29 and Starks? It's part of the standard of review section in the case.
Mm-hmm. If I can help, because this wasn't counsel's brief. This is page 9 of the amicus brief, and it describes the fact that we referred to the Sixth Amendment as opposed to the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
And then paragraph 41 refers to, instead of saying that the motion was exhausted, it needs to say that it's expired.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. I'm looking at it now, and I agree. If there aren't any further questions, I suppose I'll sit down, although I'm already seated.
Yeah, right. Would you wait just a jiff, because I'm looking at 41 and to be sure that I'm on track with what we're being asked.
Let me get to it as well.
Okay, fine. I finished looking it over. I think I understand what was the concern. So thank you very much. Any other questions for counsel before we move to rebuttal? Okay. Counsel Meyerhoff, I guess you're up.
Well, I would, most of the controversy here is about the remedy, and I would propose that you change the language in Starks to not contradict Rothering, and that you could then send the case back to the Court of Appeals with directions that they send it back to the Circuit Court for a decision on the merits. And there is some language in 807.072. which says that you could construe a writ of habeas corpus filed in the Court of Appeals as a 974-06 motion and then state to the Court of Appeals that the proper forum for that is the circuit court, and then send it back to the circuit, have them send it back to the circuit court for a decision on the merits. And I agree with the argument made that we can't jeopardize my client's federal rights by dismissing the case and tell them to refile. I agree that that argument could be made that he did everything he could and that the federal deadline should be extended as if he filed properly, but we can't depend on that, and I don't see why we should put him in that jeopardy. I would ask that you send it back to the Court of Appeals with directions that they send it back to the circuit court.
Okay, thank you. Anything else you want to add?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel, okay. I have a question.
Yes,
and
please.
That is on page 6 of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers brief. They suggest that it should, that Warren's direct appeal should not go back to the Court of Appeals, but actually should go to the circuit court. You disagree with that on remedy? Hmm?
Well, no, I would certainly agree that that's a proper outcome, and whichever way you do it, with send it back to the Court of Appeals with directions, they send it back to the circuit court, or send it back to the circuit court directly would be fine with Mr. Warren. Either way that we get it back to the circuit court for decision on the merits is what we ultimately want.
So the public defenders, the suggestion that we resurrect the original 974-06 claim as a separate thing, you are not advocating that outcome.
Well, what would be the difference between what you're saying, what they said, and just sending it back for ultimately to the circuit court for decision? Are you saying that it would be dismissed first or start over, or just have you send it back to the circuit court?
Well, I'm not going to speak for them, but I understood their argument to be, one would be sending. I understood what they understood them to say, and correct me if you heard differently, please clarify for me. But they were asking us to not deal with the current habeas petition, but to resurrect the original 974-06 motion, which was contended was inappropriately denied. And you're saying, let's go ahead and take this habeas petition and send this back down either through the Court of Appeals or directly to the trial court for an adjudication of the merits of your client's claim. So different procedural routes, but that's what I understood the options to be, and understood you to be advocating something slightly different than what they were advocating.
The only reason why I said I thought it might be more logical, because what you're doing now is you're deciding an appeal of what the Court of Appeals did. So rather than bypassing them, just go to them with direction. But either way that it ends up in the circuit court with a direction that they decide the merits is okay. And either way you do it, I have no preference between either way that it's done.
Any more questions for counsel? Okay, well, this will conclude our argument then. And I want to thank counsel, all three of you. The briefs were very good, very helpful. We appreciate your drawing the court's attention to things that we write in opinions that at the moment seems perfectly clear, but it doesn't always work out so clear when it's applied later on. So we will conclude this argument. The court is going to take a 10-minute break. And then we'll be back for our second argument of the day. So we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.